Chapter 20. Salvation's Reach.
"Wait," whispered McCall. "Wait."
"It was clean,"
Larkin protested, lowering his rifle.
"Yes," McCall agreed. He adjusted his tagger beam. "You hit the pin. But look."
The beam from the chief scout's scope lit up a fat black cable wrapped in tape running down the side of the device Larkin had just crippled.
"Secondary trigger," he said.
"Faith,"
murmured Larkin. "What's it set to?" asked Gaunt. Domer was busy with the auspecs.
"I'm reading some kind of sack under the deck flooring there. To the right. I think it's a compression bag. Put your weight down and it squeezes air or fluid into the trigger cable. Thrown. I almost missed that."
"Secondary trigger suggests tighter security," said Gaunt.
"We're about a kilometre and a half inside," said McCall. "If our friends' plans and memories are accurate, we're close."
Larkin had reloaded.
"I can sever the cable. The trigger's partly obscured."
"Do it above the trigger," said Domer. "Even if you only partly snap the line, the pressure will vent backwards out of the breech. Do it under the trigger, and the force of the shot could blow fluid or air up into the trigger anyway."
"Thanks for the tip,"
said Larkin, taking aim.
"It should work," said Domer.
"Should,"
said Zered.
"I like to leave room for circumstantial variability," said Domer.
"Yes. Go faith yourself," said Larkin, taking aim.
McCall waved Gaunt to one side.
"Larkin's getting tired," he said quietly. "His hands are unsteady."
"He's all right," said Gaunt. "He was born unsteady." The rifle popped. There was a thick slap of water and glass.
"And we're still alive,"
said Larkin.
"He's taken out 18 devices so far," said McCall. "The sustained stress has taken its toll."
"We're all trained for this," Gaunt replied.
"And part of that training and planning involved an agreement to sub out shooters or sweepers if they started to show signs of fatigue."
"Sub them out for whom?" asked Gaunt. "You heard what happened to Gamma. Pilar and Kuro were the two reserves with lanyards, and they've been called in to support Dower."
"We've got other shooters."
"Nobody who's trained this hard. Nobody this good. That's why we had so many washouts during preparation," said Gaunt.
McCall marked off the device with red chalk. They began moving up again along the rusty vault. The walls were so corroded, they looked like they were dripping in green and white ooze. They'd barely gone 40 metres when Domer called in another hidden charge. Larkin began to mark it out. Gaunt signalled to the main force advancing at a distance behind them to stop and wait.
"Raise then, not Banda," said McCall quietly. "Get Creed or McTass to break off and regroup with us."
"Rays and Banda have both done a dozen or so shots each," said Gaunt. "They're no fresher than larks. We're committed and we're out of options."
McCall sniffed.
"That's your call. But I don't think Larkin's got more than 3 or 4 sound shots left in his finger."
McCall turned to help Larkin line up. Gaunt walked back to the main force.
"The Fegus says we're close," said Ron.
"How close?" asked Gaunt.
"He recognises this corrosion. He says 2 or 3 chambers on, we'll reach a hatchway that leads into the complex proper."
Gaunt looked at the Etigor. Mabon was flanked by Brostin and Varl. The rest of S Company detail was nearby. Mabon had been allowed to make notes on a data slate. He showed Gaunt his sketched plan.
"You see," said Mabon, "we're very close. You should get the troops ready."
Gaunt chewed his lip. "How sure are you?"
"About 90%,
said Mabon. "This is a vast structure, and my memories are not perfect. But I spent several years here, and everything on this route has looked familiar. It's been what I expected.
No surprises."
90%, Gaunt asked.
"Yes."
"If Larkin,
was 90% accurate, said Gaunt. We'd all be dead by now.
Then it's a good thing I'm not the one shooting out the triggers, said Mabon.
There was a pop behind them, another saline round. The world did not dissolve into light and concussion. They had survived another step. Gaunt waved up the vox.
This is Strike Beta, Strike Beta. I want transport ready to follow us in. The route is marked. Do not deviate. Wait for my word.
Understood, Beltane replied.
I'll signal Captain Oboe.
Gaunt turned to the long waiting line of ghosts that formed his fighting strength.
Get ready, straight silver, he said. It seems we're coming up on it.
The ghosts fixed their war knives in place. In the Armaduke's Preparation 7 hold space, they were waiting by the Taurus units when the call came through. Obel listened to the vox, nodded a few times, and handed the horn back to his operator.
Unload the munitions, he ordered. These 8 vehicles here, load them with the empty carry crates. One driver, one spotter in each. Come along.
Blenner walked over to him.
Orders? Strike Beta's called in transport. They're about to get their hands on what we're looking for.
Blenner nodded.
I'll lead this, then, he said.
Obel frowned.
I've been waiting all day for a chance to...
he began.
I know you have, but this is just a transport duty. In and out, lugging freight, my kind of job. I'll use bandsmen who can drive a unit as a crew.
I would like to voice my objection, said Obel.
I hear you, I do, said Blenner. But I outrank you in this circumstance. Look, Obel, any minute we could get the call to send active fighting reserves to the excursion deck to support Strike Alpha. Combat drop man, that's your kind of job. Let me take the band in to drive the cargo. That's just grunt work. Don't waste your time with it. Wait here for your chance to do the thing you actual heroes do.
Obel made to reply and then stopped.
I just paid you a compliment, Captain, said Blenner.
Obel shook his head and laughed.
Good luck, sir, he said.
Oh, I won't need that, said Blenner.
Blenner walked over to Welder. His heart was pumping harder than he really liked.
Time for work, Captain, he said.
Welder looked at him.
Really? Another munition restock?
No, something much more stimulating. We're going in to support Gaunt.
Select 8 drivers and 5 spotters.
5? Asked Wilder.
The others will be you, me, and the boy there.
Shit, Commissar, Wilder hissed. Gaunt's son? Really?
He needs to do something before his confidence withers and dies entirely, said Blenner. Come on now, he called to the bandsman. Let's look like we know what we're doing. Perdet, you'll be my driver.
Felix approached him.
You want me for this?
It's just a little trip. You'll enjoy it. Something to do, Meritus.
I'll ride along, said Madalena.
There's no room, so you can't.
Sorry about all that. No, I'll bring you back in one piece. Promise.
No, said Madalena.
Yes,
Felix exclaimed.
You are bound by Imperial Guard law, Bledder told her.
It was a basic condition of you remaining with this regiment. I know that as a fact, so I have authority and I'm exercising it. Go away. Let the boy do something today so that when it's all over he can look his father in the face without feeling ashamed.
Madalena, dear beloved, stared at him. Her jaw was tight.
I do not like you, Venom Blenner, she said.
They all say that at first, he replied.
He stared right back at her.
My dear mamselle, if I worried about all the things in this fething galaxy that didn't like me, I'd never get out of bed in the morning.
He turned away.
Shall we go?
He asked. Creed shone her lamp pack into the darkness overhead. Her clearance team had entered a vast cavern that seemed to be a natural formation, because time and compression had crumpled the walls and ceiling so much. Micas and alloys glittered and wrinkled like rock. The deck beneath her feet was rusting plates, forming a path across oil-stained rockcrete surfacing.
"Hold up!"
McClake called out. He tuned the dial of his sweeper.
"It's mined," he said. "Under the floor plates."
Banda wiped sweat from her forehead.
"Great," she said. "How do I shoot out the trigger, then?"
"Can we lift the plates up?" asked Lair. "Disable the mines manually."
"That sounds like a gigantically bad idea," said Creed.
"We go round, then," said Lair. "Off the path, onto the rockcrete."
McClake shook his head.
"I'm getting nothing at all off the rockcrete. Too dense for a clear return. There could be filament charges or remote triggers. I'm just not picking up."
Creed breathed deeply.
"So we find another way," said Chiria, easing the weight of her flamer back. "Go back to that last junction. Take the other spur."
Banda put down her rifle and leaned against the cavern wall. She was trying to regulate her stress.
"Listen," she said. "You never mine an area you can't disarm. That's a scratch company basic rule."
"That's not always true," said Lear.
Banda shrugged.
"All right, maybe not in an open world where you've got the luxury of space. Space to go around. Space to detonate from a distance, but not here."
She looked at Creed.
"Think about it, Tona," she said. "They wouldn't wire up a main route like this if they couldn't unwire it again later. In case they needed to. It stands to reason. They couldn't set this off safely to clear it. The concussion would blow right through the tunnels."
Creed thought about it.
"Which means," said Banda, "these charges must be defusible. We can lift the plates."
McClake nodded eagerly.
"Because they won't have pressure releases," he said. "They won't be triggered by weight coming off them. Just weight being applied."
"Can you do it?" asked Creed.
McClake nodded again.
"It'll make a change from taking pot shots," said Banda.
Creed looked at Sharia.
"Go back to the troop support and get them to back off at least 50 meters, she said.
"That won't do any good if we set this off,"
Sharia objected.
"It'll make me feel better," snapped Creed.
She looked at Banda and McClake.
"You're up," she said.
They put on gloves and got down on their hands and knees. McClake slid the sweeper set alongside him as they crawled along, keeping an eye in the Auspex unit.
"This is the first one," he said, halting.
Creed and Lair stood watching, intent. Banda drew her war knife and fitted the tip of the blade under the edge of the corroded deck plate.
"Steady," said McClake.
"Really?" Banda replied. "I was just going to flip it up."
McClake got right down so that the side of his head was on the ground. The moment the plate lifted, even a finger width or less, he could see under it.
"Do it,"
he said. Banda began to lever up the edge of the plate. It was thick and very heavy, and the knife blade was polished so finely the plate looked in danger of slipping off it. She prized the edge of the plate up about 2 centimetres and very quickly got 3 fingers under it before it fell back onto the pressure trigger.
"Thrown alive," muttered Lear to Creed. "I can't bear this."
Banda swallowed, adjusted her grip, and slid the knife out. McClake still had his head pressed to the ground.
"Ready?" she asked.
He nodded. She started to lift. It was heavy. She wouldn't be able to hold it for very long.
"Stop,"
said McClake.
"What?"
Banda asked. The plate was no more than 3 centimetres clear on the side she was lifting.
"Don't move it any higher,"
said McClake.
"Oh, right. Just sit here, holding it. The underside is wired,"
said McClake quietly.
"It's got a pull-away wire hooked to the trigger cap. Lift it any higher, and it'll fire."
"Now, you tell me," said Banda.
Raze took a sip of water from his flask. His throat was as dry as Jago. There was a soreness on his right arm that he didn't like.
"Fit?"
asked McTass.
I'll do, said Rays.
He stopped at his flask, put it away, and got up.
Where is it?
McTass's team had advanced into another engine room, a giant, rusting metal box full of rusting metal machines. It was the third in a row that they had slowly picked their way across. Preed speculated that they were all parts of a ship, a shift ship that had been compacted into the mass of Salvation's Reach centuries before. It reminded them of the corroding, jury-rigged hulks the greenskins used. Every surface was a drab, flaking, autumnal shade of rust. They were coming out on a gantry halfway up the height of the chamber. The gantry became a metal bridge that stretched out to a hatch on the far side. Support was from metal bars that descended from the ceiling. It was a long way up and a long way down. Brennan had swept the chamber and located an electrical source in the bridge halfway along. The central span was wired up to pressure plates under the approach span. A major charge lurked under the bridge, secured in a fuel barrel and lagged with swathes of oilskin sheet. Rays chambered around. He had officially lost count of how many shots he'd taken that day.
"Line me up," he told Preed.
The scout took out his scope and put the tagger beam on the trigger mechanism, which stuck out of the bundle under the bridge like a spigot.
"Got it?"
Preed asked.
"Yes,"
said Rays, setting his rifle scope. McTass waited behind them with Cyrus. Cyrus had turned his flame unit right down to the slowest rate. McTass glanced back to the troop element, waiting 100 metres back down the corridor. The Belladone sergeant, Gorlander, at the head of the column, shot McTass a quick nod. Brennan edged forwards beside the shooting team and swept again. Just his weight and movement on the gantry made it stir and creak.
"Faith," McTass breathed.
Small scabs of rust fluttered down from the pins supporting the structural bars. Most of them billowed away like dead leaves. Preed gently caught one of the largest before it could land on the wired bridge span. He was pretty sure it would have been too slight to activate the pressure plate, but there was no sense tempting fate.
"Take your shot, please," said McTass.
Rays lined up.
"Wait,"
said Brennan. His scope was showing something else.
"There's a second charge at the other end of the bridge. It's wired up to the same pressure pads as the first."
"Faith,"
Rays whispered.
"What do we do?"
asked Preed. Brennan took a deep breath, thinking.
"Take out the first as you were," he said. "Reload fast, take out the second. In between times, pray that the impact of the first shot doesn't throw the second trigger."
Rays took out a second saline round and stood it on its brass base beside his knee.
"Line up both shots in advance," he told Preed. "We'll plug both sets of range parameters into our scope so I can take the shot, load, and switch to the second."
Preed nodded. Rays's palms were sweating. The blast hatch was scarred and coated with rust, but it held power. McCall touched the release and raised his weapon as it whirred open. Silence. He took a step forwards, weapon still aimed. Bonin and Ezra were by his side, with Brosten just behind them. McCall felt warmth in his face, heated air circulating, an atmospheric pump. There were pendant lights in wire cages hanging from the brushed metal ceiling of the hallway. Some were lit, some were dead. He stepped through the hatch. The hallway was ribbed. The wall panels, battered old slab-cut metal sheets, had been painted with crude yellow symbols that made him feel uneasy. He could smell foul biological waste, oil and heated metal. He could hear a generator chugging close by, and deeper, more faraway sounds of major machines at work. Patches of the floor were scorched, as if fires had been lit and left to go out. Piles of discarded junk, unidentifiable fragments of rubber and metal salvage, were heaped in the corners. Bonin edged down to the first junction. Ezra checked the nearest doors. The metal swing doors opened into little stone cells, like a jail without locks, sleeping quarters, monastically simple and spare. There were dozens of them, and then others above them, accessed by makeshift metal ladders, and others above that. A honeycomb of cells that stretched away into the darkness of the roof space. They advanced a little further. Gaunt had followed them through, trailed by Rowan and Varl and the Fegoth. Gaunt shot Mabon a look. The Etagor nodded and pointed ahead. Gaunt holstered his pistol and drew his sword. He signed for silent approach. The ghosts slung their rifles over their shoulders and drew their blades. Two figures emerged from a hatchway up ahead of them. They were soldiers in brown leather webbing and yellow coats, sons of Sek. They paused to mutter at each other. They turned to head in different directions. McCall took one down with his knife, cradling the corpse all the way to the deck. Ezra put a rainbow quarrel through the spine of the other. Gaunt approached and glanced at the bodies as Bonin checked the hatch the enemy troops had emerged from. The sons were big and corded with muscle built from punishing training regimes. They stank of spices and dust. Their uniforms were bleached, faded guard surplus, patched up and dyed yellow. The belts and leatherwork they wore were finely made and polished. Their weapons were freshly stamped las rifles, probably from some hijacked Forge World shipment heading for the front line. The masks were curious, the helmet chin straps ornately broadened to cover the mouth, with the life-sized simulacrum of a human hand. Gaunt looked again, more closely. The leather hand had fingernails. It wasn't a simulacrum. The ornate boots, belts, straps, and other leatherwork worn by the sons was tanned and cured from skinned victims or enemies. Gaunt got up, and they moved on. The chambers felt like crypts. Wall paint was flaking, and only half the light sources worked. There was a litter of junk and signs of scorching everywhere. Somehow, Gaunt had been imagining something more organised, something less like a slum or a derelict hive-hab occupied by vagrants. All the metal surfaces flaked with rust, scabs of brown and black and yellow. Old wire braziers fluttered with open fires. Wires hung down from the galvanised metal ceiling frame. They crossed a broad area like an open yard that was piled almost knee-deep with old, worn, faded, and discarded rebreather masks. The cracked eye slits seemed to stare at them. Then there was another bank of monastic cells, climbing like a cliff face into the mangled junk vault of the chamber. A hatch opened into another hall. The space was filled with huge zinc baths, glass sinks, glass flagons, and metal cooking pots. They were placed side by side on the floor, as if they had been arranged to catch drips from a leaking roof. All of the vessels, large or small, were filled to a greater or lesser extent with blood. The stink was terrible. Much of the blood was old, decomposing, clotted with rafts of mould and decay. Some of it seemed fresh. Beyond that, there were more of the monastic cells. Leading the way, Bonin, McCall and Ezra had silenced two more sons, along with some kind of robed official, who was dressed like a hierophant. This creature's malnourished, pallid form, replete with tattoos, was wrapped in a crude, wire and metal armature under his robes, a frame that seemed designed either to support him or torture him. The joints had chafed and cut his flesh. The frame reminded Gaunt a little of the wire wolves of Geryon. Gaunt glanced at Mabon, quizzical. "A weapon right," Mabon wrote on his data slate. Mabon had told Gaunt that the weapon rights were a fraternity of technical adepts who operated the Reach manufactories and had served the malign Heritor Asphodel. They would now be serving a new Heritor, enabling him to function as Sek's principal arms provider. Their prowess was likened to the tech priests of the Adeptus Mechanicus, though they relied far less on augmetic body modification and far more on esoteric and forbidden lore. Gaunt nodded. He checked behind him.
The troop element was advancing into the active section at their heels. McCall had made sure that the bodies of the ghosts' kills were dragged out of sight and thrown in the cells. McCall signalled. He and the scouts fanned out.
"These cells are where the weapon rights rest and meditate," Mabon whispered to Gaunt. "We are remarkably close to one of the main colleges, the Colleges of Heritons."
"The manufactories," Gaunt whispered back.
"Yes, but more like labs," said Mabon.
McCall returned.
"There is a suite of chambers up ahead," he reported. "An extensive complex. Bad light in there. A weird light. There are people at work. Men like the one in the robes. Servitors too, but not like any I've seen. There's stuff there. Benches of it. Shelves. Alcoves. I saw artifacts. Books. Charts. Data slates."
"That's the target," Gaunt replied. "Decide the order of attack. We need this to be discreet."
"We'll never do it silently," said McCall.
"Quietly, then, and quickly." He looked back at Mabon. "Will there be defences? Things we can't handle?" Mabon shook his head.
"Some of the things the weapon rights craft here are so volatile, they have to be kept inert for fear of interreaction. The Reach's principal defence has always been its inaccessibility."
Gaunt looked over at McCall. The chief scout had finished briefing the men. He gave Gaunt the nod. Gaunt signed, "Execute."
Three prongs moved forwards, fast and quiet. McCall led one, Ron the second, and Bonin the third. They ran down a long, paved hallway with towering walls the colour of mud, and under the broken, stained glass dome of a large circular chamber that rivalled many temples. The floor was littered with fireburns and blackened rubbish. This area of the Reach had been deliberately designed and constructed. Compartments and rooms had been cut and dressed with stone. Decks had been paved or bound in iron. On the walls, strange murals had been painted, abnormal views that were barely intelligible and curiously disturbing. They seemed to be views of alien landscapes or records of macabre ritual ceremonies. Gaunt felt as if they were invading a cathedral precinct, a cathedral precinct that smelled like a library and a machine shop and a latrine, and that had been buried deep underground, lit by the ruddy glow of simmering lava. The College of Heritons was a trio of long, high halls, linked end to end with a series of side chapels and annexes to either side. Its floor was hammered copper, and its walls were carved ivory inlaid with silver threads and bio-organic mechanisms. Strange objects stood in alcoves or on bench consoles. There were shelves of books and data slates. Some of them had been chained down or welded shut. A vast and ornately carved bank of wooden pigeonholes along one wall contained millions of hand-numbered scrolls. Larger devices, some partly disassembled, lay in the side bays and machine shop chambers, shrouded by mirror-glass screens and silk canopies. The copper floor was blanketed with junk and salvage, like a garbage dump. The ghosts rushed the area, entering from three sides. A weapon right, his head braced and held painfully erect in a frame of wire and brass, lifted his gaze from the cogitator he was dismantling at a bench and looked at them. His fingers had been amputated and tools implanted in their place. Machine oil trickled out of the corner of his mouth.
"Voichet Jag Hodgkut?" he asked,
perplexed by the appearance of people he didn't recognise. McCall put his dagger through the wretch's heart. Other weapon rights nearby, looking up from their study or delicate manufacture, were killed quickly with blades. Others got up and made to run or cry out. The first shots were fired, quick bursts of las that cut robed figures down. Bonin hit one who fell and overturned his workbench. Delicate wirework creations, glassware and brass instruments crashed onto the copper floor. The acolytes and servitors assisting the weapon rites were distressing confections of machine skeleton and grafted human meat, fused through an amalgam of augmetics and artificial tissue. The ghosts shot them too. They died with shrill, squealing cries.
Some tried to scurry away or raise the alarm. They fled in every possible direction through the long, bizarre halls of the college. Strike Beta was thorough. Several sons of Sek appeared at the far end of the first hall, disturbed by the cries. Varl killed one, and Cardass clipped and then finished a second before serious gunplay could begin. A third ran for cover and began to return fire. His head vanished in a pink mist. Larkin had made the shot from the main entry. He hadn't even had time to take out his longlass and put away his rifle. He had simply slotted a hard round into the old gun's breech. 43 metres, a target moving into partial concealment.
"Who says I'm tired?" he muttered.
Inside 5 minutes, the ghosts had the college area secure.
"They will now know we are here," said Mabon.
"Of course," Gaunt noted.
"Simply from the cessation of activity and processed data," Mabon added. "But with the primary raid going on, I'd say we have half an hour before they properly realise they have a second crisis on their hands."
"Let's get to work," said Gaunt. "McCall, bring the transports up as close as they can come. Bring the empty crates in, 2 squads. Rowan, set up a perimeter. Etagor, tell us what to take and how it should be correctly handled. The rest of it we burn. Then we get the Feth out."
"But we do burn it," Brosten asked.
Gaunt nodded.
"Just checking," said Brosten.
The 8 Taurus vehicles rumbled into lateral 16 and drove through the borehole into the reach. Inside, the rate was slower. They were following the route that McCall had marked out, picking up his chalk marks with their headlamps. The ship's artificers had moved in after the troops and cleared some areas, but space was still tight in places. Where devices had been secured, the drivers had to use extra care not to snag or disturb the packed explosives. Blenner rode in the first Taurus. He felt the sweat on his back, smelled cold air and exhaust fumes. It was times like this, he thought to himself, when a bottle of sugar pill placebos just didn't cut it. Where was that nice Medicaid curse when you needed her?
"Easy, easy," he urged Perdé.
Her hands were clenched on the wheel, her eyes wide with concentration and tension. 2 vehicles back, Felix held onto the cabin cage with one hand and cradled his las rifle in the other. The empty carry crates rattled in the back of the vehicle. He was actually doing something, for the first time in his life. He was engaged in an activity that could lead anywhere, and that his mother couldn't absolutely control with her power and money. Now it was happening. He wasn't sure exactly what he thought of it.
"My arm's too big," said McClake.
"Oh, that's fantastic,"
Banda replied through gritted teeth. Sweat was beading her face. Her arms were beginning to shake through the strain.
"I can't hold this much longer, and I can't lift it any higher.
I just can't get my arm in under the plate far enough to reach the wire," said McClake.
He looked at Creed. There was panic in his eyes. Creed got down on her knees beside Banda, pulled off her gloves and rolled her left sleeve up. Her arm was more slender than McClake's. She had a better chance than either Lair or Chiria.
"What do I do?"
she asked, gently sliding her hand in under the heavy metal plate.
"Find the wires," said McClake, "without pulling them out. Gently."
His hands were bunched tightly together, fingers interlocked, as if he was praying all the while he watched her.
"Go really slowly,"
he implored her.
"I am going really slowly,"
Creed replied, reaching further.
"Not too slowly,"
Banda grunted.
"I can't do slowly."
"Holy faith,"
Lair said to Chiria.
"I can't look,"
said Chiria.
"I've got them. I've got wires,"
Creed said. There was no way to reach in and see what she was doing at the same time. She was groping under the metal slab blind.
"All right," said McClake, nodding. "Trace them up to the slab. Up. Do it really gently. You do not want to pull
anything out by accident.
All right, said Creed. She bit her lower lip in concentration.
Don't follow the wires back to the firing cap, said McCleek. Go up.
Yes, I understand what up means, Creed said.
Do any of you understand what quickly means?
Banda gasped.
I've got the wire, said Creed. I've got it at the top, where it meets the plate.
Is it soldered? McCleek asked.
No, it's wound onto a metal terminal.
All right, good. So, without pulling it, unwind the wire and detach it.
Staring at the deck, her arm in the hole, Creed grimaced.
That's easier said than done. I can't get hold of the end.
When we're done here, murmured Banda,
I've decided to kill everybody.
If we don't do this right, said McCleek, that won't be necessary.
I've got it, Creed said. I've picked the strands loose. Wait.
She looked at them.
It's off, she said.
Are there any other wires? McCleek asked.
On what?
Cried Banda. Creed gingerly felt around.
No, she said. No, there's... Wait. No. No other wires.
Then we lift it off, said McCleek.
Creed drew her arm out. She and McCleek got their fingers under the plate beside Banda.
On three, said Creed.
Three, said Banda. They lifted. As it came away, the deck plate exposed a dull grey anti-tank mine buried in soil beneath. A wire trailed from the pressure pin on the top. They put the plate down in the path beside the hole.
I have to make it safe, said McCleek,
taking out a pair of pliers and kneeling beside the mine.
I do not want to do that again, said Creed.
Rays fired. The shot was perfect. The saline charge blew the firing cap assembly out of the device under the bridge span. But the recoil also made the gantry shiver unpleasantly. Preed lined the tagger up on the second trigger cap quickly. Rays scooped the waiting round up off the deck beside him and reloaded. He reset his scope and locked onto the point that Preed was tagging. His finger curled around the trigger, ready to squeeze. Small flakes of rusty metal trickled down from overhead, disturbed by the recoil. McTass caught one before it landed. A second, no bigger than a rose petal, landed on the first span of the bridge.
Off,
McTass began. The pressure switch clicked. The second charge at the far end of the bridge blew. The force of the detonation instantly shredded the entire length of the bridge into rust particles and ignited the first charge. The combined blast lit the chamber like a supernova. McTass, Preed, Cyrus, Brennan and Rays were simply atomized. Concussive pressure split the chamber walls and forced a titanic shockwave back down the access tunnel. The pressure blast liquidized Sergeant Gerlander and the troop element waiting in the passageway behind them. The rushing, sucking fireball that squirted up the tunnel incinerated the pulped remains a millisecond later.